This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com. Hey, around we go, playing that game. Sell, move, use,
be done. They want us to stay. Hey, around we go. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Irreplaceable Truths, where we uncover realities and lessons learned in the world of veterinary medicine. I am your host, Dr. G, and I'm very excited to have Danny Robin here with me, owner of Ready Vet Go, a 2004 Davis graduate. She really is amazing. I met her 2.5 years ago when I just became a member of Vet Partners. And that was when I decided that it was time for me to step out of the clinical arena and try to do something else to help save the profession. And she was on the same page as me. We're going to go into deep dive in what it's really like mentoring in veterinary medicine, lessons learned along the way from her as well. Why don't you give us a little bit about your journey, Danny?
Okay. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I was just remembering when we met at that Faithful Vet Partners meeting, which was so much fun, and we clicked instantly and have a lot of shared visions for this profession and love for the profession. About me in a nutshell, like you said, I'm Danny Rabwin. I'm a 2004 grad from UC Davis. So I have my 20-year reunion coming up, and I'm really excited to get together with classmates I haven't seen in a long time. I love veterinary medicine. I'm a real champion and cheerleader for this profession. I wanted to be a vet from the time that I was little. A little bit different than other veterinarians, I wanted to be a veterinarian because I really loved people and I loved connecting with people through helping their pets. I love pets, but the love of pets isn't necessarily what drew me into the profession. And I've had a really exciting career journey that we'll probably talk about. I've been in clinical small animal medicine for 20 years. I'm still in the clinic a couple days a week. And a few years ago, I launched a remote mentorship program. It just started with me remotely mentoring 4 new grads all over the country who need a little extra help. And it turned into a very big and exciting remote mentorship program where we are going on now helping close to 150 new grads and lots of different practices that they are affiliated with. And we've grown to having lots of mentors and a very robust mentorship program that I'm excited to talk to you about. And my journey outside the clinic has brought me to meet a lot of interesting people like you, which is my favorite part.
Well, I wouldn't really call myself interesting. I'm just very opinionated. And as Dr. Peter Weinstein has told me a few times, I don't have that many filters. So if I drop a couple F-bombs, and by the way, an F-bomb is a medical term. If I also, so if we go a little nuts here, I apologize from the beginning. Because I'm with you, I really think veterinary medicine is no longer, I think it's, when you and I started veterinary medicine, there were so many cheerleaders for the profession. Nowadays, I feel as if it's, everything I read and what I hear is all like, you know, doom and gloom type stuff. We haven't really had a great chance to take that back because... you know, you started mentoring, I believe, during COVID. And COVID was a nightmare for veterinary medicine. What was your experience as far as the amount of clients and pets you saw compared to pre-COVID?
Oh gosh, COVID was really challenging for so many of us. And I agree with you. There is, you know, just what you were saying before about doom and gloom. I think there's a lot of doom and gloom out there. And I think, honestly, there's a lot more of us who are still really happy doing what we love. And we're just, you know, like nose to the grind every day, doing our job, seeing our patients and taking care of our clients and not out there telling the world how much we love VetMed. So I love that you have this podcast and that you're, you know, kind of helping amplify the voices for that are cheerleaders for the profession. To answer the specific question about COVID, it was hard. I was working at the practice where I'm still working a couple of days a week. It's a 6-doctor practice. We're very busy. And you probably heard some people in our profession actually kind of liked COVID when things were curbside because they didn't have to be in an exam room with a client. Not all of us are people the way I am and the way you are. And so they liked it. And I didn't. I had a really hard time with that. I use a lot of nonverbal communication and I really love connecting with my clients. I love catching up about their kids and their grandkids and what they've been up to. And a lot of that was missing when we were curbside. And everyone was so stressed. And I found that wait times were really long. It was a lot harder to get into the vet. Our parking lot was just exploding and people would sit in the parking lot and they would like doom scroll their pet's symptoms. So by the time I got on the phone with them, they already had, you know, looked up so many things. And, you know, I didn't mention this, but I also do relief emergency, and I've done that my entire career. And so I did more of that during COVID as well. And so when it was curbside, I really found that there was a lot of this kind of, you know, looking up symptoms, already having just so much fear by the time we got on the phone with them. We weren't able to reassure them with our body language that we had this, that things were under control. So it was a really challenging time. There were some benefits to it. The new grad that my clinic brought on in 2020, she's the reason that Ready Vet Go, my mentorship program, came to be, because she was my mentee in 2020 and she started curbside. And there were some advantages to being a new grad during the pandemic. Nobody was asking her if she was old enough to be a veterinarian because they couldn't see her. She had an opportunity to hang up the phone, look things up, run things by me, and not have to come up with a treatment plan while in the exam room with a client. So I think there were some benefits, but overall, I think it was a really challenging time for our profession and for pet owners. It was really hard for them.
Well, you can never tell if the pet owner was smiling because we all had masks on. So you couldn't read there. You couldn't read the room, really. It was unbelievable to me with COVID. How many people really appreciated veterinary medicine at that point, especially at the very beginning when our doors were open and we were still seeing their pets. There were a lot of clinics around where I was that was refusing to see anybody. Their doors were closed. And I made it a fireable offense if we turned anyone away, because my belief is that animals don't choose when they get sick. And the funny thing is, though, all these people were home all the time, and usually you see an animal that has a discomfort level on a scale of 1 to 10, about 5 or 6. I think they would come in at a 1.2, right? Oh, Puffy woke up this morning and he was limping just, you know, a couple steps, but he's fine now, but I just want him checked out. And it's just like, okay, you know, and we did what we did. I'm pretty amazed. I love the fact that you were able to come up with that mentorship idea during COVID, because it was so crazy. Any of the new grads that were coming out during then were going to have a very hard time creating their professional identity. And I completely agree with you that it was awesome to go in the office if you're a new grad and you could just look stuff up without looking, I don't want to say a better word, dumb, right? Because I feel a lot of times, a lot of these new grads feel that they need to be perfect. And I want to make it clear that we're practicing veterinary medicine. We haven't perfected it. So how pivotal is mentorship, do you believe, to create a professional identity? And also, you know, what should someone look for in a mentor when they're graduating school?
Those are two really big questions.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
I think mentorship is crucial for creating this professional identity. But as a mentor, one of the gifts that we can give to our mentees is to allow them to create their own authentic professional identity that is unique to them. And, you know, I really feel like there's not just one right way to practice medicine. And there's so many different ways that we can grow into our professional identity. And it's really fun for me as a mentor to watch somebody come in. They're very insecure. They might have some confidence issues. Imposter syndrome is extremely common. And once these mentees are empowered with confidence, being reminded that they learned a lot in veterinary school, they know what they're doing, we can be cheerleaders for them, and then they can grow and come up with a professional identity that is really authentic to them. And that's really fun and exciting for me. And when I work with other mentors, that's something that I coach them along with, is, you know, really not having our mentees do everything the way we did, and really letting them explore how they want to practice. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because the one thing that I believe that they do not teach in veterinary school, which is very important, is the concept of emotional intelligence. And they have to understand, they're going to learn all the technical skills, but it's the soft skills that really put you over the edge as far as being that veterinarian that everybody loves and trusts. So what do you do in Ready Vet Go to help improve emotional intelligence?
I mean, that's so much of what we do, because, you know, when I started Ready Vet Go with that small group of mentees that just came to me organically before this was really a vision, we met a couple times a month on Zoom. It was myself facilitating a group of new grads. They would come to our Zoom meetings and they would generally bring a medical question, thinking that they didn't know how to manage this case. And what everybody learned very quickly is they did know how to manage the case. They knew the medicine. They learned it in vet school. What they were really struggling with is some of the things that you just mentioned, some emotional intelligence, things around connecting with clients, building trust with clients, getting clients to buy into the treatment plan that the new grad knows is appropriate, pivoting the treatment plan away from gold standard medicine, because for lots of reasons, not just financial, but values, beliefs, experience, for lots of reasons, people do not, you know, choose, quote, gold standard medicine. So how do we pivot and work with our clients? And so right off the bat, I knew when I was building a mentorship program that it did not need to be clinical. They get that in vet school, and hopefully they have somebody in their orbit in the vet clinic or somebody that they can call upon to help them with clinical medicine. We dive deep right off the bat with a mentee skills training. We really empower our mentees to take accountability for their own learning, to become self-directed learners, to establish relationship guidelines and expectations with their mentor. So they're really leading the ship. And then we dive deep into some of the big challenges, like connecting with clients, communicating with clients. We look at our own personal biases so that we can become more emotionally intelligent and aware. And we spend 7 months addressing many of those topics. We also break our cohort. So the program is a cohort-based program. We start with lots of mentees all at the same time, a couple times a year. We all meet once a month as a big group in big workshops with breakout rooms, but we also break the groups into small groups that we call PACs. And these are groups of 3 to 4 mentees, and they're matched with a Ready, Vet, Go mentor. And one of the key features of our mentorship program is that the mentors themselves have to have been out in clinical practice for at least 10 years and must have held a leadership role, either as a practice owner or medical director, or something to give them a really broad perspective on the business, the profession, our clients, because I think some of that emotional intelligence and awareness, it takes time. And while a second or third year veterinarian might be a rock star with medicine, that to me is not what matters in a good mentor. There's something more important around wisdom and experience and emotional intelligence and those things that you were talking about. So those are some of the ways that we address it. Because I agree with you. I think it's a really important topic that isn't really addressed in veterinary school.
Yeah, because, you know, I always joke around that I wouldn't take a dead cockroach to see the top 10 kids in my class. It's an art to learn to talk to a client. And a lot of people say emotional intelligence is a trait, but it isn't. And we all have it. You just need to be trained, and it comes with maturity. And I think that's one of the things that early career vets struggle with the most. Especially nowadays, the younger millennials, the older Gen Zers, and how attached they are to social media and their phones and reading reviews online, they just have to really be careful what they say. Because I did have a mentor. The one thing they taught me about client education or client communication during vet school was that 3% of your clients are going to make you hate your job. It's going to make you forget the 97% that are just absolutely incredible. And it's hard, but you'll learn, I guess you learn after time that you're not going to be everyone's cup of tea. You're not going to make everybody happy. And that's the whole idea of perfectionism again that comes into play, because let's face it, you had to do pretty damn well academically in undergrad to become a veterinarian. And I make the argument, we should open up a vet school where everyone was out partying at frat parties and with, you know, the football teams and got the 3.1 and want to go to vet school, because those are the grinders, right? But that's a different talk for a different time.
I think should be out doing those things and working in retail, maybe working in a kitchen, you know, having some experience outside, you know, just cleaning cages in a kennel or working at the barn or whatever it is that we all have to do to have experience to get into veterinary school. There's so much around customer service and leadership that can come from some of those other jobs that maybe aren't going to count to get you into vet school. But I think those things are important, just the way you think, you know, going out and partying and going to the frat parties and doing all that is important too. You know, being well-rounded, because, you know, our clients, they will connect with us in ways that are beyond what our grade point average was. And they don't really care. They want to know that we care, that we can connect with them. And so, yeah, I mean, I agree with you.
How many clients have asked you your GPA in vet school?
Right. Yeah. None.
Correct. What do you call the kid who graduates at the bottom of his veterinary class? A veterinarian. So yeah, exactly. There's a lot more. I mean, it's crazy because I look at the veterinary education. Did I really need to take a whole semester on poultry? Did I really need a whole semester on virology? I mean, seriously, I remember during my clinical rotations, we had to go sit in morning classes, and we had a microbiologist come in, and he was like, "What would you do if I sent you a report that said I have a coagulase negative, gram positive cocci?" And I raised my hand immediately. I said, "I'd go look for a different lab because I want you to tell me what the bacteria is and how to kill it." I'm sorry, I mean, I was a big asshole in vet school. But, you know, the thing is also, I also went out and I learned a lot from my professors because I made sure I was very, I interacted with them outside, right? So for veterinary students right now, if you get a chance to do anything outside of veterinary school with your professors, do it. You'll be amazed what you might learn, right?
That's great advice. I didn't do too much socializing with my professors, but I can see that there's so much value in it. I feel like in true Dr. G fashion, you're opening up a whole can of worms talking about the things that we learn in vet.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Veterinary school, I definitely, you know, also was resentful of my poultry class, but I also think it's cool because we look at both of us. We've been in this profession for many years and we're pivoting, and our degree allows us to do so many different things. So while I can't imagine a world where I would ever go into poultry medicine or become a microbiologist, we can. I mean, we have that training, and so pros and cons to all of it. But I agree with you. It was not my favorite.
Well, you know, the one thing I thought is the problem I had with veterinary school, and it really hit me as I was getting older through veterinary school, is that my professors were incredible, right? I didn't have a problem with my professors, but they were professional academians. They were never out on the front lines. And one of my mentors, who was actually a groomsman in my wedding from before I went to vet school, he's the one who told me, those who do, do; those who can't, teach. And I was like, why the hell would you even tell me that? But then I started getting it, because they kind of paint this picture that everyone that comes in is going to want to do an ultrasound, a CT, a blood panel, X-rays, all these things. And it's not the truth. So, I mean, what was the hardest reality that you faced your first year out in vet school?
Well, that is a really interesting question. I think it kind of ties in to what you were just saying about vet school and the professors that we have in veterinary school. You know, one thing that I really struggled with, this doesn't answer the question of my first year out. This was more around my clinical year. I knew very certainly that I wanted to be a general practitioner. I love general medicine. I still do. And I would go through my clinical rotations and I would be on some service, and the specialist on that service would say, oh, you're so good at this, why don't you specialize? Rather than saying, oh, you're so good at this, how exciting that you can now take this skill and bring it into general practice. And I felt this pressure a lot at the teaching hospital to, you know, go and specialize because somehow I was, quote, good. I'm not really sure what that meant. But I feel like this is still an issue because of a lot of what I hear from new grads who I talk to through our mentorship program, or I'm just meeting out in the community, is there's a lot of fear around doing things that they perceive, quote, should be transferred to a specialist. And there's so much that we can do as general practitioners to meet the needs of our patients and our clients that do not involve us transferring everything. And so I think I had fear my first year out. And I think that's a big thing that I'm trying to reset with a lot of the new grads that I work with, is fear of messing up, fear of a board complaint, fear of doing something that somehow we're told we're not qualified to do as veterinarians or as general practitioners and not specialists. I don't know how you feel about that, but my first mentor basically took me under his wing, and we were semi-rural. He said, I'm going to teach you cowboy medicine. Our clients can't refer. You need to be the one to do it. And I did it. And I think that is partly what has given me so much joy and love for this profession, because I've been able to take big risks, scary risks, and really able to provide good care. And so the fear is something that I think is a real challenge. It was for me, and I think it's something that resonates with me when I'm chatting with the new grads today as well.
And I want to make sure I make it perfectly clear. Dr. Danny and myself think we need specialists. But you, yeah, right, exactly. But you do not need to be a specialist in order to do procedures. I feel as if a lot of people coming out now think general practice is nothing but vaccines and looking at ear cytologies, and that's absolutely not correct. The cost of care has gone through the roof. I mean, a basic example, a cystotomy. Cystotomy is easier than a spay, in my opinion. Whoever says a spay is a straightforward procedure is full of shit. There is no such thing as a straightforward procedure when you're doing a spay. But a cystotomy is an easy procedure. It's quick. It's very rewarding. And I have new grads that were coming out saying, I'm going to refer this. And I was like, why? And they're like, oh, because we were told that a surgeon should really do this. Well, yeah, a surgeon can do it, and he can probably, they could do it for probably $12,000, $13,000. And if they don't have veterinary pet insurance, that's where the whole emotional, you know, intelligence piece comes in, because you're going to have to sit there and think about, okay, what do you think that client's going to say to you when you're saying, I'm sending you to a surgeon, and it's $12,000, $13,000? And they're also going to, you're going to feel awful as a new vet. And that's why that mentoring piece is so important. You need to be with someone who's going to hold your hand. And I'm not trying to put down internships either, but I don't believe an internship's going to teach you how to do a cystotomy, because the surgeons will do it. And you'll probably, if you're lucky, get to close the abdominal wall, maybe the skin. So you're going to see one. But as I always tell everyone, my way of mentoring has always been see one, do one, teach one. And I think that's the way these new vets need to think. So when you're mentoring these kids, and because you said something very interesting, and let's say they unfortunately did mess up doing something, how do you get them over that fear of messing up again?
This is such a good question. Mistakes are going to happen. They have happened to me. They've definitely happened to you. They didn't just happen in my early years. I'm sure that I've made mistakes recently. Some mistakes can be catastrophic. Sharing our mistakes with each other and hearing from people who are still happy in the profession goes so far. I can't tell you how comforting it is for new veterinarians to just hear about the mistakes that I've made. And I am very open with them. I'll tell you something really interesting that just happened to me a couple of days ago. I was invited to do a workshop for a big corporate group that is doing a mentor training program, an internal mentor training. These are experienced veterinarians who are getting extra training to become better mentors to work with new veterinarians. It was a call. There was about 200 people on the call, and I shared with them a mistake that I made, and the pet died because of a mistake that I made. And it was very vulnerable for me to share this in front of my peers. I share that story in front of new grads, and I don't feel quite as vulnerable and scared to share the story because they're new veterinarians and I'm much more experienced with them. And I share it because I know that they like to hear it. I made a mistake. A patient died. And I am still here to talk about this. And I shared this in front of colleagues and peers, and I was so nervous. And then I put them in breakout rooms, and I said, in pairs. And I said, privately, I want you to share your biggest mistake with each other. And I gave them 10 minutes in a breakout room, and we came back, and the chat was blowing up with experienced veterinarians saying, that was so cathartic. I thought I was the only one. I've never said that out loud before. That keeps me up at night. 20 years later, I still think about that case. Even experienced veterinarians, we carry these mistakes with us. We're deeply empathetic. We care about what we do. And we make mistakes and we learn from them. And if we can share them with each other and not pretend that these things didn't happen, I think it is super powerful. I didn't quite realize how powerful it was going to be for a group of seasoned veterinarians, but it is. And I said, okay, now imagine how you just felt. Take that back to the mentees that you're working with and be vulnerable and share them, because it's meaningful. And it's really helpful, I think, for new veterinarians to know that the mentors that they look up to have also made these mistakes. We've learned from them. And we move on. The other thing I always say is that our wins far, far outnumber our mistakes. And the other important piece about being a mentor is, yeah, let's talk about our mistakes, but let's remember our wins, because as veterinarians, we're really good at remembering our mistakes. The wins are way, way more in number. And so that's something that I think is extremely important. I end every meeting that I ever have with a mentee with a win, because they're more frequent, and those are the things that we really need to be remembering.
Well, that kind of brings me on my next question. Like, many young vets or many veterinarians go into this profession because, let's face it, we have a passion for animals, right? Unlike Dr. Danny, who has a passion for people, but that's a she's an oddball when it comes to that. But once the realities of long hours, stress, mistakes, asshole clients, horrible online reviews start to kick in, you start getting your student loan bills. Do you think passion is going to be enough to get these students through? And if not, what do you recommend?
Oh, goodness. Passion alone is not going to do it. Passion alone, I think, will get people through veterinary school. But there are some things, I was about to say simple, and I don't know if they're simple. They're certainly not easy, but there are some tangible things that people can do to help counter some of the doom and gloom that you just listed, which is unfortunately kind of a reality of this profession. I would say surrounding yourself with people who love the profession and who can be a cheerleader for you is really important. I can't tell you how many times I go into a veterinary school and I give a talk on something and people come up to me later and they thank me for being so positive, but that's not the message that they're always receiving. And I think, what a shame that vet students are receiving anything other than messages of positivity about this profession. Being armed with what the realities might be and some tools, like, that can be helpful, but I don't think it's up to us to be spreading doom and gloom for people who are about to step into this profession. Now, arming them with some tools, like a network of people who they can call upon, and that can be both people in the veterinary profession, but also without. I think I hear from a lot of vet students that some of their family relationships kind of suffered when they were in vet school because they were so busy. So really reconnecting with support systems is extremely helpful. Having open dialogue and communication with mentors, coming up with things outside of the veterinary clinic. So just, you know, really obvious things that I think we need to remind ourselves of over and over again: eating well, bringing healthy food to the clinic, having a plan for nutrition, because it is so incredibly important. Taking a break during the day, stepping outside, getting some fresh air, even if it's just for 10 minutes. I coach some of my mentees who are open to it on incorporating a breathing practice, because I think that that really is something that has helped me. Therapy for those who need it, and not shying away from that. But what I hear time and again from people is the community piece. People want community. And forming a community where you get together on a regular basis with somebody who you can share some of the struggles you're going through, knowing that you're not alone, hearing from people who have been out longer than you have and are still thriving is really, really helpful. But this is something that I'm always kind of like trying to look out for different ideas. And I'm going to turn it back and just see what your answers are to this question, because there's so many different ways to answer that question. And I would love to know what the Dr. G answer is for that.
Well, I think the passion will be there, but I think trying to just make yourself every single day a better person Veterinary medicine is fluid, and in my opinion, veterinarians are fear change all the time. What really got me through was all the new technology, all the new toys, new procedures, new medicines, going to CE, and learning new things really reinvigorated me. Like I remember it was my first year out, went to Vegas, of course. You got to go to Vegas your first year out, you know, because nowhere else can you go to a 1 a.m. meeting. And I remember learning about corneal ulcers and the trick of using serum, the dog's serum, as drops with the antibiotics to help the ulcer heal quicker. Now, that's so old school, and it's poo-pooed by a lot of people, but guess what? It still works, and it's easy to get. It's right there. And if you're like, hey, I just found out about this new procedure or this new way of treating this, and we're going to try it, the client's like, oh, cool. So that's what I did as far as when things got hard. I also am kind of sadistic when it comes to clients being assholes to me. I always put that as fuel to my fire, as like a fuck you to them. I always tried to make sure that, you know, whatever pissed them off, I would make sure that, number one, I never do it again. But number two, I'd go over and above the correction. You got to have a mindset of I'm always going to be better every single day. There's a theory that I'm using in my research called preservative cognition, which talks about rumination, which is you go home and think about that case over and over. And you know, it also includes worry, which is you wake up the next day and you worry that it's going to happen again. And you can't live in that doom and gloom mentality. You know, Dr. Danny and myself, we're here because we think this profession is absolutely incredible. And it's brought you a lot of fulfillment. It brought me a lot of fulfillment. Not as much as I thought I was going to get towards the end, but that's why I'm doing what I'm doing now. But I think, you know, and I always made sure that I mentored 20 people into vet school for my practice, of which all 20 of them are still practicing. And I always try to make you, I try to make, you got to be able to make fun of yourself, right? You got to laugh at yourself sometimes. You got to realize you're human. And it's so hard. It's so hard to even think it's there. But my passion never left me personally. I don't think the passion's ever left you. From the way you talk, you just find new ways to ignite that passion. It's like a marriage, a relationship, you know?
I love thinking of it that way, different ways to ignite your passion. When I was hearing you talk about like going to CE your first few years out, like obviously Vegas is so fun. It can also be kind of like a lonely experience if you don't have a buddy. And so really, you know, some people have to get out of their comfort zone to go, you know, there's thousands of people. And if you don't know anyone, sometimes it can be a little bit uncomfortable, but it's such a great place for networking and learning new things. I also learned the serum trick with the eye and used it. It's so tempting to go to a conference and learn about something new that's super expensive. And then you go back and you ask your practice owner for that thing and they laugh at you or they say, no, you're not going to get that. But if you go back and you can do something that's basically doesn't cost anything, you're taking the pet's own serum for the corneal ulcer. It's such a great thing to implement. It's so much fun. But I was thinking, I was remembering my first, like many years out, actually, I would have a theme for the year for what I wanted to learn. So my first like 3 years was ultrasound. Everything I did was ultrasound. I put all my CE money towards ultrasound. I did some like creative negotiating with my practice owner, committing to a longer contract time in exchange for extra ultrasound training. And so that was kind of my first few years out. And then I got on this ClinPath kick. And so all my focus was on ClinPath. It was a really great way to kind of help me. I love the way you just said it, kind of reignite my passion. So like I would set this goal. It would be my kind of guiding light for what I was going to choose for my continuing education for that year. And then I could bring those skills back into the clinic. I could do ultrasound on my patients. I could read cytologies in-house rather than having to send everything out and have people wait for 3 days wondering what their pet, you know, has. for a diagnosis. So I really love that idea. And that is definitely something that I did as well. So that kind of resonated with me the way you just said that. I also remind people just kind of like, remember your why. And it can seem a little bit cheesy, but the why really is what can help you stay grounded when you are dealing with an angry client, or you're not getting out of the clinic on time, or you're tired, or you're filled with worry. Having the why as your guiding light, I think, is also something really great. And I kind of like review my why every couple of years, just because it changes. Our whys are going to change over the years as we have life experience. But that's always kind of helped me stay grounded as well.
Well, for all you listeners out there, Simon Sinek is who she's talking about with the why. And if you don't know who Simon Sinek is, look him up, watch his video on the why. It will change the way you talk to clients. It will change the way you interact with your family. It will change the way you view your profession. And it is a profession. It does not need to be a job. If veterinary medicine ever feels like a job, what I tell people is that they're at the wrong clinic. Do you agree?
Yes, for the most part. I think for the most part, yeah, it is a profession. But I also want to just remind people that if at times during your life it just feels like a job and you have to just get up and go to your job and do your thing and go back home, that's okay too. And, you know, maybe it's not what's going to get you out and happy for 20 and 30 years if it's always that way, but it does kind of fluctuate. But for a lot of us, I know it feels like a calling. I know it's felt like that for me. It does feel like a profession. It's bigger than just a job. And also, there have been times in my life where it's just a job. And that's okay too. And we don't have to always have that, you know, excitement and passion at all times. But the overarching theme is more of a profession rather than a job.
So, you know, we kind of hit it. Talked about it a couple of times. I'm going to try to nail it right now. We all know there's asshole clients. And usually that their negativity and their, incivility, let's just call it incivility, happens commonly in early career veterinarians, more than when you get older. How do you tell these new grads, your mentees, how to deal with a client who's just over the top?
I would say it depends, but for the most part, my feeling is, I'll be curious to know your thoughts about this as well. I don't tend to use the same kind of language as you. Shocking, I know. I don't refer to my clients as asshole clients. I feel that I've only encountered real asshole clients a very small handful of times in 20 years. There is asshole behavior. And I think that behavior, for the most part, comes from fear around their pets or something else that has nothing to do with us at all. And it might be that when a client comes in and is really angry and their hands are across their chest and they take advantage of the new veterinarian because they know that they're, you know, not going to be as experienced as Dr. G, who they've been seeing for the last 20 years. It might be because they were just sitting in the waiting room for 30 minutes and they weren't greeted by somebody at the front desk. It might be because something awful has happened. Their child might have been given a diagnosis of some health condition that we don't know anything about. And so I advise people to lead with that and to go into these interactions with the assumption that it is not about us, to tone down our language, our posture. If our client is sitting down, pull up a chair and sit down and you can name what's happening in the room. Mrs. Smith, you seem really upset right now. I really want to help understand why, because I think we both have the same goal of getting Fluffy the care that she needs. Is there something that I can do to help change this situation? It's super vulnerable. It's very hard to do. I'm a huge proponent of role-playing because practicing saying these things is very awkward, but it works. And I think it will teach us that the majority of the time, people are not assholes. They're scared or they're dealing with something that we can connect on. Asshole clients happen. I came home and I told my partner last week. I said, for the first time in a long time, I was screamed at, and I used all my tools. This was a client that I knew. My tools didn't work. This client is just off the rails. So it happens. I know that, but it's actually, I think, pretty rare. And as much as you use the language around asshole clients, I would be willing to bet it's probably pretty rare for you too. Just, no, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people don't love your direct way of communicating as much as I do. But that is how I approach it, and honestly, I think it works.
Well, no, I mean, it's an emotional intelligence piece. As I got more mature in my profession, you learn your craft, you learn how to talk to them, you learn how to take advantage of the situations as far as, and I don't mean taking advantage of the clients, but you learn, you read the room, and you learn, you become that different type of person. And I'm not going to try to get into my research and talk about, surface acting versus deep acting and all these other things. But honestly, what I always tell people that when I was mentoring people, I go, number one, not everyone who owns an animal is crazy, but all crazy people own animals. And the second thing I told them was that you just need to just take a step back, relax. If you ever are uncomfortable in a situation, just say, I'll be back in a minute. Find your mentor, find the manager, find someone who's going to deal with it. There were probably 15 clients who I sent records to. And I'm going to warn, early career vets, if you sense a red flag, trust your gut instinct, because those are the ones that usually turn out to be the worst. Luckily, I never was taken to the state board. The worst that ever happened is I got destroyed on Yelp. And when it would get to me or a Google review is when my kids would see it and they would ask me about it. But I would have to tell them, I'm like, they just don't like me. What can I do about it? But that took, Danny, that took 12, 15 years to learn. And you gotta believe in your why. You gotta go back to your values. And the biggest thing for me is integrity. If you are doing the right things, even when no one's watching, you're gonna be okay. And you can go to bed and sleep okay because you did the best you can. And, when I say asshole clients, I just mean they make you feel like crap. Because they can destroy your day, your week, sometimes your month. I've had associates that do, my wife's a vet, right? She still talks about a client that upset her 4 or 5 weeks later. And that's human nature. But it does lead to a lot of emotional exhaustion, which eventually leads to the burnout and the attrition rate, which is the one thing you and I want to avoid. That's why we're doing this. This is why we're talking today. People, you, I, so it's so hard, and it's not an easy thing. But I got to ask you, what was the worst client interaction you've ever had?
The worst client interaction I've ever had. A blessing and a curse for me is that I really let things go and forget about them. I am going to go with the one that I don't know if this is the worst, honestly, but because it's the thing that just happened to me a couple of weeks ago, it is the most present. And this was a client that I've been treating her pets for 12 years. So I've known her for a long time. And she was extremely upset about, okay, this is, I screwed up. I screwed up. And so I earned a little bit of annoyance, but I didn't earn the vitriol that came from this. I wrote in my record and asked the technicians to radiograph the wrong leg. And then the pet went home and we realized our mistake. And I called and I said, I screwed up. I am so sorry. I need you to come back. And we had to do this before. I mean, you know, when have we forgotten to give a vaccine? Or, you know, these things happen. These things happen. We own them. And we have this person come back. And this is a client who has a reputation for really making the staff uncomfortable a lot. And I had never, we know this as doctors, that we sometimes don't see the behavior of our clients, because when we walk into the room with our stethoscope or our white coat, it all goes out the window and they're perfectly fine with us. So I kind of knew what some of the staff had said, but I had never experienced it myself. And when I called to tell her that I needed her to come back to re-radiograph the other leg, she just like went off and was yelling and screaming, and I ruined her day, and she planned her entire day around this, and she might have to look for another vet, and she's fed up with everything. And I was so, my heart rate was going up and my hands were sweaty. And I was like, this is, why am I being talked to this way? And I said that to her, I don't know why you're talking to me this way. This is so awful. And in the end, I said, how long have I known you? And she said, 20 years. And I said, well, I've only worked here for 12. So I've known you for 12 years. It hasn't been 20. Has this ever happened before? And she said, no. And I said, do you think I deserve to be yelled at like this? She said, I don't remember exactly what she said, but it ended up with an apology, but I had to really coax it out of her. Cause I said, I don't know if I can move forward until you really acknowledge that this is not something that is routine or warrants this kind of response. So I did get an apology, but it has made me think did it even need to get to that point? If she had a reputation with a staff, why do you still allow her to stay as a client? And we've had some big discussions in our clinic around that. I'm remembering one time during my first year, I worked in an emergency clinic and I had such an angry client, that we had to basically like lock the treatment doors because she was, you know, yelling so much. I hate to talk about these because they're really not that common. But I am remembering, you know, over the 20 years that there are a handful, and no matter what you do or what you say, sometimes people are just gonna go off.
But you still remember it 20 years later. And that's the point I'm trying to get at. Like, I had a guy who had a German Shepherd and it was wobbling its rear legs. And I'm like, I'm worried this is degenerative myelopathy. I'm going to have to send you to a specialist. And he went to the specialist. He couldn't believe he did an MRI and spent all this money. And the MRI showed nothing. But of course, the blood test showed it was degenerative myelopathy. And he literally was so pissed that I just didn't do the blood test. He asked me to step outside because he wanted to go to fisticuffs. I opened the door. I said, let's go. I mean, I'm not a small kid. And he's like, no, that's okay. That's okay. Yeah, I mean, I have stories. But I, again, incivil clients are the clients that treat the staff poorly. The only reason I was so successful is because my staff was incredible. They would lay down in front of a moving bus for me when I wasn't there and protected myself, my family, the clinic, both my clinics. So I that's why when I say asshole client and civil client, not just to you, you know, I mean, I feel horrible for the receptionist. I mean, you got to look at receptionists. They're the first person they talk to. They're the first person they see when they walk in the door. And they're the last person they see when they get their credit card returned to them. So, I mean, that's why. And I mean, that all goes into play. They could treat you like you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. But if you treat my staff poorly, I don't have time for you. Sorry. Because you got to support your staff. But the one thing I want to go back to that you just said, which was so important, is you picked up the phone, you were honest with the client, you communicated that there was a mistake, and you need to do it again. That is so important for new grads to understand that it is okay to do that. It is okay. Communication is key. What's going to keep you from going to the state medical board or getting sued? Communication. And write it up in the chart. Write it in the chart that you talk to the client, because then you're covered. I mean, you didn't charge them for that extra x-ray, did you? I'm just wondering where your corporate veterinary medicine stuff is going now. But I'm just wondering.
Charged for that mistake that I made. You're so right. I mean, you know, one of my early mentors, I remember standing in the treatment room and I had made a mistake and I was just petrified to call the client and let them know what happened. Everything turned out fine. I honestly don't even remember what the mistake was. What I remember is role-playing with my mentor in the treatment room. And there was one of those like old phones that was on the wall. And I remember standing there with my hand on the handle of the phone, getting ready to dial and role-playing with my mentor about what I was going to say. And he really coached me through that conversation and it went fine. But I was just so nervous around making that. And it taught me such a good lesson. You know, I will have my staff and technicians make lots of phone calls on my behalf, but taking the wrong x-ray, you know, even if it was something that was totally on me, I told the techs the wrong leg, but even if I told them the correct leg and they did the wrong leg, that's still a phone call that probably I will pick up and make, because ultimately it's on us. And it just goes so much farther to smooth out that relationship if we're the ones picking up the phone and calling if something like that happened.
Yet she still yelled at you, but that's fine. We understand. But I mean, that's the thing, right? Again, we're calling it practicing veterinary medicine, not perfecting. So there are going to be mistakes. I mean, the hardest phone call I believe I would ever have to make is when an animal passed at the clinic. Those were always the hardest ones. And I can't tell you the emotional toll it takes on you. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with being vulnerable on the phone when you're calling a client discussing that. It doesn't mean you're weak. It doesn't mean you did something wrong. It just shows that you're human and you have compassion. And, you know, and the thing is, did you read that article the other day? It came out. It said 87% of the people polled believe nursing is the most honest profession, and veterinary medicine was second at about 72%. But the only thing I could think of is, here I am sitting here thinking of how come all these veterinarians are coming out of school scared, already knowing about burnout, already knowing about the struggles of paying off their student debt. I think it sets them up the wrong way. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of things that need to be changed from the very high up. And I think it needs to start at the school. And I think what you're doing is commendable, working with these young vets. One last question really quick. Running a business and being a vet, right? If you're going to do both. Look at you. You're an associate veterinarian and you have a side hustle, right? How do you pull yourself back from the edge when you think things are getting out of control?
With regards to being a business owner, is that what you're asking?
Your life, work-life balance. Like, I call it like running in mud, right? Because you're getting nowhere. You feel like your life's getting out of control. You feel like practice is getting out of control. What are some tips you tell young kids, other than breathing and stuff like that? What are tips you tell them to make sure everything, all the checks and balances are there? Because veterinary medicine's a grind. It's hard. It's exhausting. but are there any trips, any tricks you can give them to try to just maintain balance, which will be next to impossible, but there's always the shot to try to do it?
Yeah, I mean, balance is really hard. Like you said, it's like next to impossible. And, you know, I've talked to some people who even hate the phrase work-life balance. Like, is that even a thing we can strive for? I don't know. I think looking at, you know, all of the different buckets in one's life that can help ground them. So, you know, tools that we have in our arsenal, you know, you said other than breathing. So breathing is one, exercise is one. Like for me, the main thing for me really is my social connections. And I think that is important for so many people. And we've kind of moved away from that being in such a digital world and doing so many things remotely. So the thing that I really encourage people to do is to try and strengthen those connections. You asked me like how I do it. Well, for me, because I'm now only in the clinic 2 days a week and the rest of my time I'm in this chair, in this office, in my house, running a remote business, it can be quite isolating. And for me, being social, that doesn't work for me. So I need to do things that are going to help connect me to people. I also need things scheduled. If it's in my calendar, I do it. So scheduling time for me to go to my yoga class is super important. Like I need to have that on the schedule. I also have learned over the years to anticipate when things are going to be stressful at particular times and budget in more downtime around those times. So like I'm in California, as are you. We're at hopefully near the tail end of foxtail season. But in my clinic, foxtail season is exhausting because we have a full schedule of regular appointments. And then we're fitting in tons of fit-ins for a dog who was just on a walk and snorted a foxtail up its nose or just got in between its toes and it needs some sedated procedure. And it's going to be super, super busy. So I might not book things for myself after work that day because I know I'm just going to need some more downtime. I also have to give myself some grace. Like it's okay if certain things that I feel are like good for my well-being go on the back burner. If I have to like drive home from work and pick up pizza on my way home because I'm not going to be able to cook for myself, that's fine. It's giving ourselves some grace. I think we can like be so hard on ourselves. The other thing around like, you know, that's more relevant to this stage in my life where I'm juggling a business and my associate veterinary career is scheduling things, like I just said, around very stressful times. So I'm going to a lot of conferences over the next year because I'm doing speaking and networking and that sort of thing. And conference season is going to kind of ramp up at the sort of around December. And then it's going to slow down again for me around March. And so I know to bookend those things with a couple of days where I'm not in the clinic and scheduling my time off accordingly so that I can really regroup and have some downtime. I know this is a lot of rambling and there's so many different ideas, but I think it varies from person to person. So for me, it's social connection, really strengthening those connections, putting effort into maintaining those social connections, and scheduling downtime. Those are big ones for me. Does that answer your question?
Well, the thing is that I just wanted to prove to people there are things to do to get back your work-life balance.
They're very tangible things. You just need to find out what works for you.
And then, you know, if they start a family and they have children, that just adds to it. But it's all doable. It's all doable. You know, I was a full-time vet. My wife was a full-time vet. And we have three amazing daughters, but we still did it. And you know, I just feel as if they need to find the practice that understands that there is more to it. You know, I had a problem when I sold my practice to corporate. They actually had a regional manager meeting and they were yelling at all the practice managers because all the practices were closing at 5 or 6 o'clock at night. And they're like, you realize your clients have jobs. You should stay open till 8. And my manager raised her hand and said, what am I doing from 8 to 5 or 8 to 6? Is that not my job? And I said, you know, the best thing for you to say would have been like, hey, when your kid was sick and you got home from work at 6:30, was your pediatrician still waiting there for you? No, that's why we have amazing urgent cares and emergency clinics. And that's the problem, is that a lot of, like, especially now, and this is my opinion only, not yours, you know, now that we've gone into the corporate realm of veterinary medicine, everything is run on a spreadsheet. And of course, you know, the computer is telling them, oh, you could get a little extra revenue if you stay open till 8. But they don't realize what it does to the person who has to stay there till 8. And, you know, that's another discussion I'm going to have probably with other people, because that's not something I would ever ask you at this point. So last but not least, where do you see veterinary medicine going? With the cost of care going through the roof, with veterinarians right now struggling out of school, what would you like to see happen, let's say, in the next 5 years?
Yeah, this is a big question. One that I hope you will answer after I answer. I think things are going to have to shift. You know, I don't know that I want to open the can of worms around, like, corporate medicine and all of that, because I think, like with anything, there's lots of different sides to many things and pros and cons to many things. But I do see, like, I'm hearing more and more around a swing back towards independent practice ownership, which I think is a really interesting conversation to be having. There are some creative ways that people can own practices, but that's something that I hear kind of swinging back. I would like to see a world in which general practitioners are empowered to provide care to help break some of the cost of specialty care. So to provide a little bit more advanced general practice within their own clinics, because like you mentioned earlier, to refer for a $10,000 cystotomy is, I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's really particularly good for the profession. It's certainly not good for the client's pocketbook. We can be providing more of those things in-house. So I would like to see us empowering our early career vets to do more of those things in-house. I also would like to see a more diverse veterinary profession. I think that's going to really help us connect with the communities that we serve. We are moving in that direction. There are, I think the recent AVMA report was 25 or 27% of veterinary students now are from minority and underrepresented backgrounds, which is not nearly enough, but it's way better than it was. And I'd like to see us continue to move in that direction, because I think having a more diverse profession is going to help the profession and the communities that we serve. So I think those are my answers around independent practice ownership, around being able to provide more procedures and services and more advanced care within our general practices, and adding diversity to the profession. I think those are reasonable to see within the next 5 years and beyond.
Yeah, I know you want me to answer it. I mean, I would love, and remember when Dr. Danny and I are saying, do the cystotomy, we're not talking about, and I want to get rid of the term, average client transaction. A lot of emphasis is placed on that, especially once new grads get out into practice. I think empowering these early career vets to know that they are capable of doing a lot of stuff if they have the correct mentor there, holding their hand for as long as it takes for them to get the confidence in themselves to become and create that professional identity that they envisioned when they were getting into vet school. I think a lot of these veterinarians envision veterinary medicine when they start vet school as something spectacular. Part of my research is looking at the amount of stress people go through, whether or not they had a pre-veterinary job, pre-vet school job, working in a veterinary clinic or not. I would hope that soft skills would be taught a lot more in veterinary medicine, because that would make it in vet school, because that's more important than technical skills. I believe in EQ over IQ. I'm not saying, you know, we're going to take people in that got a 2.4 GPA. I don't believe creating more vet schools is the answer, which they're doing, because who's going to teach these veterinarians? A lot of these new veterinary schools are in risk of losing their accreditation due to not being able to pass the national board exam. I just think veterinary medicine right now is a mess, and we need to get it under control. There was the AVMA statistic, 8,000 jobs available, or 7,800 jobs available right now. We're only graduating 4,000 veterinarians worldwide a year. And amongst those, 34% of them will be out of the profession in the first 10 years. That's not a sustainable profession. And you and I love this profession so much that I think we need a lot more cheerleaders out there. And that's what I hope to do with this podcast, is get all the cheerleaders in here. I hope the listeners will actually email me questions that they want to know, drg@vedmedit.com. I really want to make sure that myself, my guests, and I hope to have Danny. I want to have Danny in studio as much as possible, because I love this girl. I love what she's all about. I think she's amazing. But I really think we need in the next 5 years, we need stronger cheerleading. We need the legacies that have retired and are no longer heard from because they were so fried to come out of the woods, get back, and just be cheerleaders and supporters of this amazing profession. So, Danny, I can't thank you enough. And like I said, next time Danny's here, she's going to be in this studio. I want her to sit here at this desk with me asking questions as well, because I know she's just as concerned as I am about everything. So where can they go to visit you? What's your website address?
The website is readyvetgo.co, and our socials are at readyvetgo.
Phenomenal. Danny, it was so great talking to you. Congratulations again on your son going off to school. I know that's been a big change. By chance, any interest by him being a veterinarian?
No such luck. I tried, but no such luck. It was fun having him work summers at the clinic with me.
Yeah, we're 0-3 as well. And I think it has a lot to do with what they saw mom and dad deal with every day. But you know, that's how it goes. But I just want everyone out there to understand that there are people like Danny, there are people like myself, there are going to be people like all my guests that are always going to be there to give you that supporting hand, that shoulder to lean on, you know, the shoulder to cry on. Don't be afraid to be open. Don't be afraid to make mistakes, because unfortunately it's going to happen no matter how much you try to avoid it. So Danny, thank you. I will talk to you soon, and you got it. Oh yeah. And I'll see you all later with the next, I messed it up. We'll edit it out. I don't care. I'm tired now. Okay. So, okay, Danny, I know you got to go. So thank you.
That was fun. You're like in your element.
I am. I try to avoid the whole corporate thing for you. I know that's a big client of yours, so that I didn't want to go there.
Thank you. I know. That was nice. And you had to write me in about the specialist too. Danny's not saying she doesn't like specialists.
Yeah, exactly. No, I just.
It's not mine.
It is. Well, I mean, the thing is, like, and that's why I have Dr. Gassel come in this afternoon. I want to talk to him about truly is an internship worth it.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because you could get paid. What is it? What do they get paid now? Like $25,000 a year? And they're basically a slave. And what do you learn? Right? Versus if you get...
I did one. I liked mine, but, you know, like I tell this story. I didn't tell this one today, but I've told it in other places. Like, speaking of spays, at my first job after my internship, I went in and I was spaying a fat Labrador, which, as we all know, that's the hardest surgery you'll ever do. And I called in the practice owner to help me. And he just walked in and he goes, "I thought you did an internship." That's what he said, rather than help me.
Well, hold on a second. How many fucking spays do you do on an internship at a specialty hospital? The only spay you do it on an internship at a specialty hospital is one that got fucked up and it's bleeding to death.
Exactly. So it was the rudest thing. And then I went and worked for Buff. So
guess what? We got that on recording. We're going to keep that. That's going to show up. Yeah, it's going to show up.
Okay.
So, okay, Danny, thank you. I will talk to you soon.
Next time in the studio, have fun.
Okay.